Tarps off. Best podcast in baseball is back. And to help me get through it with this scratchy voice of mine, I've turned to the best talker I know. That's right. It's Kevin Wheeler's return to BPIB to help us kind of look at what's happened at Busch Stadium and can it last? Cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a best podcast in baseball brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. This is Sports Writer. Let me try that again. Sorry. I'm out of practice, Wheeler. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball brought to you by Closet by Design. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and I apologize for the long absence from BPIB. I have a good reason. I'm sure it's a shared reason for a lot of folks. I got absolutely whacked by allergies and completely lost my voice. I could not carry on a conversation for like more than 7 or 8 minutes or get through a press conference without flurries of coughs and sneezes, much to the chagrin of a few of my fellow reporters who, at least one of whom really took issue with it. So I guess I should apologize for coughing. I don't know. But anyway, So I haven't been able to host a podcast because I can't talk for much longer than a few minutes, really basically just a radio hit. So in order to get through this, and we'll see how long this goes, I'm turning to the best talker, the most talkative dude I know, the guy I haven't been able to keep up with because I haven't been able to talk. So I just listen to him. And that's, of course, KMOX's Kevin Wheeler. So I'm about at my limit here. Kevin, take over.
All right, brother. Well, let's go. Tarps off. Too bad we're not doing a video version, huh?
Right. No, we both are. We are both swirling our shirts around as we speak. So just everybody, just think of that image. It's basically, you know, what I'm trying to think of what, like, if you were to take Henry Cavill and Hugh Jackman, that's basically what this is. It's just the two of us swirling our shirts around.
Pretty much. We're both Patrick Swayze from the Chippendales bit on SNL.
Right. Yes. And not Farley. Correct. That is correct.
Kevin, what do you make of this?
I mean, look, it happened organically. You know, yes. Longtime listeners of the best podcast in baseball will know that I have been banging the table for getting a supporter section at at Busch Stadium. I've written in the Post-Dispatch that they should have the STL City supporters come over there and bang the drums just to get something going. This is what happened. The Stephen F. Austin club baseball team, important to note that it's the club baseball team, was here for the club World Series in the St. Louis area. And they, you know, wanted to enjoy a ball game, and they insisted on everybody else enjoying it with them. This is spread to St. Petersburg, where there was a tarps off. We were watching the potential no-hitter last night with the A's in Anaheim, and there were tops off there swirling their shirts around. So it's spread beyond St. Louis, but is this something galvanizing for St. Louis?
It's a great question. I mean, I don't know that specifically will last. I mean, if it does, great. If it doesn't, that's okay too. But I like the example that you're allowed to have fun at a baseball game, and the energy doesn't have to come just from the field. The energy can come from the stands too, right? I mean, you look at sporting events, look at college basketball, college football. You mentioned the world of soccer, a lot of sporting events. The energy is the part of the entertainment. I'm not saying this. I know the players and Ollie, I know they loved it and it was fun. And I'm sure it made being in the dugout, raises your adrenaline level. It raises your attention level when you see everybody's having fun, and it was a great ball game. And I think that helps, right? Because if it was a 9-0 game either direction, that probably doesn't happen, and it probably doesn't take on a life of its own.
Great point.
So it's a combination of circumstances, but I hope that becomes kind of, I don't want to say the expectation, but certainly something that people are going to be okay with bringing the energy to, because it's, again, the ballpark baseball doesn't have the same energy as a lot of other arenas for a lot of reasons, right? It's just not built to have, you know, tons of music all the time. It's not built for that. It's not like an NBA game or an NHL game. And I think that that kind of fun, when it comes organically, it can fuel not just interest, but people's willingness to say the ballpark's a fun place to be. Because in the past, you and I, we've talked about it. In the past, the draw to coming to Busch Stadium was pretty much just winning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that the rest of the game day stuff is bad. It's just not a draw, right? And for the most part,
and stars. Genuine stars. Yeah.
Right. The last year with the Yachty and Albert certainly had that, having Waino around all those years, like having big stars. And, you know, the last couple of years you had star names, but guys that were in decline. Mm-hmm. And when you're having bad years, when you're Nolan Arenado and you're not playing to your standard, you're not going to be in the happiest mood, right? You're not going to be. Wouldn't it be weird if a veteran player like that was walking around and, you know, goofing and being silly when he was just not happy at all with how he's playing?
I cannot stress this enough, that the way fans were feeling about those recent teams, like kind of disenchanted and confused and wondering what the heck went wrong, that was also reflected in the clubhouse.
Absolutely. I mean,
like fans going to the ballpark and going, why does this feel weird? Why is this stale? You know, I mean, the third baseman felt that same way. Like, what, where did the St. Louis go that I played for, you know, played in for the Rockies? Like, where'd that go? And where is that constant hum and buzz about baseball? And you know, he wasn't like asking, like, where did the fans go? Where'd the energy go? And what role did the team play in it? Like, he brought that up constantly.
Oh, yeah.
Saying that, like, you know, Nolan, I can't count the amount of times we were talking and he told me, he goes, I'm part of it. Like, I'm, my performance is part of where did this go? Mm-hmm. And that's so frustrating. And, you know, so I think, you know, the way fans were feeling and they're like, why won't the team like respond to this? You know, the team was wondering the same thing, like how to get that energy. Where's that spark? Where's that familiarity? Where's that event or that person or that team or anything that brings the fans back, and so that they can like symbiotically grow something incredible. And the team recognized its importance in that, and the performance and the style of play and all that stuff, but they just wondered where it went to.
It's so many things, right? So many things that built to what we saw this past weekend. As far as the fun and the energy and the whole tarps off thing, there's so many things that contribute to the mood that you're talking about too. Like this whole run up, I think there's a part of this, Derek. And again, we've talked a lot about all of these issues, but clearly people were tired of the same old, same old, the same voices, the same kind of team all the time. Right.
You always the same experience at the ballpark,
right? Same experience.
The only thing changing at the ballpark is the prices.
Right. And when's the last time there was a team in St. Louis that had young energy? Because they've not gone that way. They've had young players,
but it's always
been a team run by older players. And again, some of that was just organic, right? I know we've said that word too many times already. I'll stop saying it. But you have Yachty or Molina, right? Yachty's going to be the tone setter. I mean, like, that's not a problem. You know, Albert Pujols, when he was in his first 11 years and even there at the end, they bring a different type of energy. Waino the same. And Waino, you know, great personality, funny, good talker, all that. But veteran players dictate the tone of a team.
I mean, you ask a great question.
Are always going to defer.
Like, when was the last team, not just baseball in St. Louis, to just be run by youth?
It was probably the Blues right after the lockout when they were doing the commercials with John Davidson going door to door and saying, come grow with us.
Yeah,
when Oshie and Berglund and Perron and Eric Johnson and all those guys were just showing up for the first time.
Yeah, that didn't go so well.
No, but it eventually did, right? I mean, that was the beginning.
Not with those players.
But it was the beginning of you growing into a window of contention. And some of those guys had to move out the door eventually to get better, right? Eric Johnson had to be moved, but that brought you Stewart. And Stewart was a big part of, you know, of your front line when you were starting to make playoff runs. And it morphed into a different team that won the cup. But that was the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And some of those guys either were a big part of that, or they had gone elsewhere, and other players that came in, like a Ryan O'Reilly and things like that, were a part because some of those players got dealt.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, I don't know we'd have a pretty good debate. We could probably have a whole podcast on when the last time the Cardinals had a youth infused team. I mean,
It doesn't mean that it's bad to have established stars. It's obviously a good thing when they're playing at peak level, because this place was full 3 million people a year for about 20 years because you're good. But the problem is, if you don't have, you have to be really good for that to work.
Right.
I guess is what I'm saying, right? If you're going to be a stoic team, if you're going to be, and some of this is a league-wide change too, Derek. You know, I mean, like 15 years ago, no teams were playing this kind of fun, energetic celebration at second base after a double and waving to the bullpen after a home run. I mean, all of this stuff is relatively new. So this is really the first time the Cardinals have had a chance to just kind of, and it's not, again, I don't want to make it out like those guys didn't have fun before. They clearly did. But there's nothing harder than having fun when you're not performing well.
Yeah, I mean, the home run props are relatively new.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, this is the bat flip generation, right?
Yes, like
the bat,
right.
The bat flip was the gateway to this. You know, you didn't see Barry Bonds, you know, signaling to the bullpen. Maybe that's a bad example. But, you know, I think that, you know, I think there were these micro celebrations all along. And sure, there were certainly teams that galvanized the city in which they were in. That's been true for years. I mean, obviously, it's within the last 10 years, but you think about Baby Shark in Washington.
Yeah, think about how mad people used to get at the Brewers.
Yeah, yeah.
For their home run celebration and the bowling pin thing. I go, Cardinals fans were legit hot about that.
Well, yeah, Niger Morgan, man. That was that was something. and then you had Zach Greinke calling Chris Carpenter a fraud, which was wild. Like, I remember being at the ballpark and going, whoa, wait, what? Well, maybe you should look at your jersey first, pal. Like,
yeah, no doubt.
What is going on? You know, I think some of this has kind of been building. Like, you can go back to the Phillies teams.
Yeah.
Certainly Sabathia and Prince Fielder and that group, Ryan Braun. I remember hearing stories about how they had planned the bowling pin celebration. Right. And there were veteran players on that team going, we're not doing this.
No, right,
and,
right, exactly.
And then coaches were like, look, you know, this could be a team building thing. If somebody's out, then it looks really bad, you know, and everybody's
right.
And so it kind of became like this. I mean, it was made for a great baseball card. It did make for a very great baseball card, but it was odd. But some of this stuff now is not like because it's happening, because they plotted that.
Yeah.
It felt off.
Yes,
but like
now it's part of the normal baseball culture.
Yeah, we were talking about that in and actually in Sacramento about and you know, we can dial this back a few weeks, and again, maybe, and I apologize for not having the podcast again over the past few weeks to kind of chronicle this upbringing or this backstory. But I was talking to Mason Wynn in Miami about the home run prop. And he was telling me that they were thinking about going and getting a Lars Nootbaar chain. You know, they got the big face of Lars Nootbaar. And they're like, you know, because Lars isn't with us, but he's a big part of you know, celebrations and a big part of the personality. And he's like, so we thought about going to get that. That didn't work out. He goes, we thought about going to get, like, maybe go get a JJ one because, you know, here's this rookie and, you know, fresh face, youth. He goes, we probably should go get a Jaywalk one because he's the one hitting all the home runs. But does that work or does that feel contrived? You know, and then fast forward now a couple of weeks, they have the dog chain, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, got some dog in you, and they have a beware of dog sign in the dugout, which is a crack up. And I cannot wait for, you know, like for Ali Marmol to run out there and argue with an umpire and say, my guys are bulldogs in the box. My guys are bulldogs in the box. But anyway, you know, we were talking in Sacramento, me and a couple of players, about, like, you know, just how theirs came about naturally from Nathan Church barking to this versus going out to buy a prop at the beginning. Right. And they were talking about the difference in that. Like, you know, it might not last because someone hasn't gone, this is what we're going to do, but it might be stronger because no one said, this is what we're going to do. And you can only know over time if it latches on.
Yeah. And look, you know, when you're consistently great, you can be a stoic team and nobody's going to care. Your fans are going to be happy because you're winning.
Yep.
And then when the winning starts to wane, though,
I would add that you need to win by a bunch of runs if you're a stoic team.
What's that?
I would add that you probably should win by a number of runs. Like, don't always have a save situation and be a stoic team because then the team doesn't reflect the emotions of the moment and it feels incongruous.
Yeah. But as long as you're winning and in contention and making playoff runs, nobody's really going to care too much. The last few years, what we saw was a declining performance and a stoic team. Mm-hmm. And those two together are not fun.
Yeah.
Those and now let's be clear too, though. Like, I mean, you I know you're going to agree with them on what I'm going to say. This past weekend isn't fun if your team's not good. If you're pulling that when your team's five games under 500, nobody's jumping on board. It's not going viral. People aren't going nuts. It's not going to have the same energy. But because the team is playing well and they're overachieving and they're a high energy team already. Before tarps off, this was a high energy, fun team.
It was.
When you get the two together, you have the chance for something cool to last for a bit.
Yeah. I mean, this is the moment in the podcast where I'll play Debbie Downer. I agree with you. I also think the stars aligned in a way that
absolutely
like, look, if the Cardinals are winning 7-1 and those guys whip off their shirts and start doing a chant, it doesn't hold on. But because Joel Pozo comes up and the game just finds him and it's a walk off. And then the next day,
perfect storm.
Yeah. The next day, they're not doing much offensively. Oh, until that team shows up. And then in the fifth inning. Now, like we can all write and we all did. And we all pointed out that that's when the shirts started twirling and the bare chest came out and everything. And then the Cardinals rally. But by the way, that was also, you know, this third time seeing the pitcher. So,
yeah,
you know, we started seeing like, right. Okay. So you started seeing, look, the Royals are not playing well right now and they played close games with the Cardinals. This can cut two ways. You can go, 100%. Well, that's very exciting that the Cardinals are winning these close games, but you should also point out that they're playing close games against every team. That's just their style of play. Mm-hmm. And that is a rubber band that the further you stretch, the harder it snaps back playing a lot of close games. So that's my context for it. So you're right. It was a perfect storm of events that led to this. And it's awesome. It's about time and it's awesome. And let's see if it carries.
Yeah. And part of that will be on the team to keep being competitive and keep playing well. Because if you go on a, you know, I'm not forecasting this, by the way. I'm just saying it, for example, if you were to go on a stretch and like say these next 18 games when you got 15 against Central Division opponents, if you were to go 3-15 there, I think a lot of enthusiasm is going to wane. Yeah. I don't anticipate that kind of run. But it's going to require the team continuing to compete and then fans continuing to enjoy. And the fans will enjoy and have fun so long as the team continues to be fun. And what I'm fascinated by, Derek, is at every point so far this season, there's been some element of this team that's not been going well, right? I mean, early on, starting pitching wasn't that great. They were giving up a lot of runs, not getting deep into games, and the bottom half of the lineup was almost helpless. And you're being carried by the top and obviously the very back end of your bullpen, because there's all kinds of bullpen problems scattered through all of this too. Sure. But, you know, and now that the offense has fallen back a little bit, well, the starting pitching has pushed forward and gotten better, and they're in a really good stretch. What's it now? Almost 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks of the rotation being really good. And I catch occasional bad outings, but mostly good, probably 90% good during that stretch.
I mean, good relative. I struggle with this. They're good relative to what's being asked of them. Let's not.
Fair. Yeah, absolutely fair. But what I'm saying is good compared to what they were last month.
All right. Well, that's fair.
Because if you look at the month of May for the starting rotation compared to the month of April, it's a big jump.
Yeah.
It's a big improvement.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a big difference. That's not the same thing as saying this is going to last. It may or may not. But I know that when the offense slid, and obviously this is never coordinated. If it were coordinated, then teams would never go into slumps. It just so happens that as the offense started to come back a little bit, the starting pitching picked up, and that's why you've been able to continue performing well.
I mean, some of that is also their opponents, though. I mean, like they started.
Oh, sure. 100%.
They started facing more swing and miss opponents. 100%. And they started facing better pitchers.
So yeah, this past stretch was all good teams.
Yeah. Yep. All good teams. But all teams that hit for damage and will swing and miss versus like that first month where the Cardinals were facing a lot of teams that make a lot of contact.
Yeah.
And that works against the team. So,
Yeah. And again, this is all going to change. I mean, I think there are legitimate red flags about some of the guys in the rotation, you know, but at the moment, the performance is what it needs to be. The outcome is what it needs to be. Mm-hmm. Will it stay that way? I don't know, but I would also not anticipate the offensive players that are struggling right now to stay that way. And then you've got the big question, right? I mean, like what's really fascinating to me, I brought this up a few different times. I wouldn't bring it up to you as a part of this specific conversation, because I think it's a big role. Mm-hmm. The impact they've gotten from Jordan Walker is the same as if they had gone out and picked up a $400 million middle of the order bat.
Whoa.
It's what they've gotten, not what they're going to get the rest of the way. What they've gotten is a 955 OPS.
Whoa.
And a guy that through a quarter of the season has 13 home runs. That's a $40 million player. Now, not saying it's going to last. I'm not saying Jordan Walker is now Aaron Judge. What I'm saying is that's one of the big differences between last year's lineup and this year's lineup. And if we had said in the offseason, we're adding that player, we're adding a Juan Soto, Kyle Tucker, Aaron Judge level player, expectations for this year would have been higher than they were coming in. But he, the fact that he's played at that level, and it's not only him, but he's the battleship right now leading your fleet.
Yeah. That is fascinating. That is like, I mean, we'll look at, okay, so Kyle Tucker is the guy, right?
Right.
So,
right.
And they're not the same age. So you are talking about a far different kind of level of. But man, that is quite an estimate. Okay. So I want
to just say, like, think about it. Last year, Jordan Walker was what? Nearly negative two war, 1.7 minus one, something like that.
He's balanced his war, yeah.
And he's already three.
Right.
He's on pace for a nine. There was one nine-win player last year. That was Aaron Judge. And Walker's on pace to be a nine-win player.
Yes.
That kind of change is a big part of what's fueled this. And there's more to it. Again, it's not just him. It's J.J. Weatherholt's presence and the fact that he's shown power early. I mean, that's 21 of your 51 home runs with those two guys.
No, that is alarming. First of all,
yeah.
That, I mean, they need more power diversity there.
Absolutely,
they need more power from.
And that should come,
but
right?
That's not a surprise. I mean,
that's going to come from Herrera eventually. Maybe when he gets back.
But this is it should come from Newt. This was a big question all spring.
Yeah.
Is the power going to come from?
Yeah.
And Jordan Walker has stepped up in the first 40 games and goes, me, anybody else? And okay, so Fangraphs does this interesting thing where they have some statistical alchemy where they put a dollar figure on performance, right?
Like, right,
what
right.
would this performance be in the open market? And right now on Fangraphs, Jordan Walker has a 2.1 war. To give you perspective on that, that's wins above replacement calculated by Fangraphs. That makes his career total 1.2, which tells you where he was. He was in the negative.
Right.
Now, part of that is defense. A small part of that is defense when it comes to Fangraphs, right? So take that into account. Now, that also has worked to his benefit this year, right? I mean, he's been playing very well defensively, above average right fielder right now.
Yes. Yeah. Especially with the improvement in his throwing.
Right. Helped by his arm, which was always his carry trait defensively.
Yes.
Regardless of what position he was playing. And it was one of the reasons why when they was like, well, put him at first base. It's like, well, did you ever see him play third? Because like what he did well was throw.
Right. He throws almost 100 miles an hour, man.
So like you're taking away what he did well in the outfield and asking him to do the things he didn't do well.
He's also a top 10 percentile runner.
Right.
Would you want those two traits at first base?
When he was drafted, evaluators within and without the organization said he's going to be a left fielder someday.
Oh,
like that's what
I figured. He was a right fielder from the day he was a high school player.
No,
he just always reminded me of Dave Winfield athletically.
Yeah. I think there's a sense that like the glove wasn't going to come around and the arm would be a weapon in left field. Right.
Mm.
Like, you know, there was that was the kind of sense. But I mean, he's more comfortable in right field, which is why he plays right field. There for a while, he was playing right field because fewer balls are hit there.
Yeah.
Let's just be honest.
That, no, it's true.
That was part of the Cardinals math. Mm-hmm. Last year, Fangraphs attaches a value to, again, performance, right? And since last year, Jordan Walker had a negative war, mm-hmm. the value is that he owed the Cardinals $10 million.
Right.
That's not obviously realistic.
but it makes a point.
But it makes a point, right? On the open market, he would owe a team $10 million. So, all right,
based on performance.
Anyway, the other side of this is that this year his performance, and you mentioned he's a $40 million player, this year his performance, if he were to stop today, is a $16.7 million player on the open market. Which,
yeah.
All right, man. Like, that's, I mean, that's a bold statement that you made, but you certainly can back it up, and that's fascinating, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they probably with JJ and with Jordan, they probably added 55 million plus in performance.
Yes.
To a team.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And if you want to think about like expectations versus reality, right? None of us had an expectation that Walker would be this. There was hope that he could be better, right? Not so much in spring. In spring training, I was worried, man. I'm like, God, is he even a major league player at this point? And then you get to the regular season and he's fine. And he's been
kudos to the coaching staff for leading that situation.
They were right. They nailed it.
And to Jordan, you know,
yes.
But they could not have timed that. They could not have read that better. They saw him chasing results and breaking from what he was doing. And they're like, man, we got to get him out of the results business.
Yep.
How do you do that?
Yeah. Obviously they found a path that works for him both mentally and look, the mental side comes with the trust in the physical side, right? When you see that you're doing things better.
Yep.
And I can't look at this without also seeing that he was able throughout the offseason and the spring, because of the team's improvements with adding staff and technology and all of the things we've been talking about for years that they were missing, you can continue to get positive feedback even if the game feedback is negative.
Yeah.
Right? Even if the spring training games, the Grapefruit League games were negative, you can still see the positive if you're in the environment where you can still measure and show it.
Yeah. That's right. That makes a lot of sense.
And I think that helps with the psychology of a lot of young players, because young players have grown up on this. They've grown up with hit tracks and blast motion and all these other things. They've grown up with it. It's their language. And it helps build, you know, we talk about feel a lot, and a lot of old players, feel was all they had. I shouldn't say old, but previous generations of players. Feel was mostly what you had. Mm-hmm. Now you can marry those things a little bit better with feedback. Feedback and feel can kind of go together. They're more attached to me than maybe they were in previous generations.
Oh, yeah. No, 20 years ago, 21 years ago, when you were to talk to a hitter, and I was fortunate enough to talk to some great hitters, obviously, back then. You know, you had Larry Walker and Jim Edmonds and Scott Rowland and a guy named Albert Pujols around the team. But also, you know, just with other clubs, you go and talk to, you know, the Joey Vados of the world and everything. Mm-hmm. And I would kind of – I mean, if I don't want to put it all on him, but certainly – I could tell when the conversation shifted toward how often Joey Votto was on base, you felt like, okay, the Major League Baseball has a very prominent player who is talking about the stats that matter.
Right.
And, you know, it was like wild. Like, and he never won a Silver Slugger, right? Part of that is because he was in the National League Central and in the National League.
Right.
There were like
you got these, Albert. And,
you had these like oaks of first
Ryan
base.
Ryan Howard, right? For that period. But,
well, I mean, Prince Fielder, Derek
Prince
Lee.
Fielder.
Folks forget how great Derek Lee was with the Cubs. You know, and then Joey Votto came into that. Albert Pujols obviously was double great, or whatever is greater than great. I believe the exact word for greater than great is Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
But you know, you had this group, but anyway, like the thought was, well, this guy never won a batting title, right? And yet he was on base more than anybody else. And if you awarded batting titles based on how you get on base or on base percentage,
right,
Joey Votto would have a room dedicated to his on-base titles, right?
That's correct.
No silver slugger. So I think you felt the conversation shifting a little bit. But 20 years ago, if I'm talking to a hitter, you can bet that they're mentioning their average as to what they're looking for. I haven't heard that in months.
No.
Like, you talk to J.J. Weatherholt, and you talk to some of these guys, and they don't bring up average. The other day, one of the players, and I apologize, I don't feel like I can identify him because it was just kind of a casual conversation.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, they were all talking about hitting, right? And one of them was like saying, like, you know, he had a bunch of hits recently. And he's like, it's hard to say I'm on a hot streak, though, when balls are just finding holes. Like, that's not what I want.
Right. He said, the quality of contact.
All right. He's like, I'm getting hits. But somebody mentioned, like, man, you're on a hot streak, meaning, like, someone, one of the reporters.
Right.
And he said, but that's hard for me to go, yeah, I am. When I'm balls are just finding holes. Like, that's not what I'm out to do.
Right.
And it was such a different conversation than when you had 20 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, when the guys are like, man, if I can just get one hit a week
right.
to fall in, that's 10 points on my batting average. You know, like,
right.
just, you know, that's the difference. That's going to make me a 300 hitter. If I can just find one seeing eye single, you know, it's just it's a very different world. And, you know, I think fans have done a great job to catch up. I'm not quite sure they're there yet. Baseball cards still have batting average on them, obviously. Scoreboards still a batting average on them, obviously. So they're still part of that. But I think, you know, for the most part, when fans see a guy who's hitting 240, they aren't dismissive of what he brings offensively, like maybe they were 7 years ago. And same goes for players. Like, you know, 20 years ago, if someone was hitting 240, they're like, what is wrong with me?
Right.
And now it's like, yeah, but what are you doing with that 240?
Hey, look, Kyle Schwarber helped change that a lot, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he's the really pretty great example of the guy that's a 230, 240 hitter. But, you know, when you're hitting 45, 50 bombs and you're a 900 OPS, nobody cares what your batting average is.
Right.
And we can see the sport doesn't value average by itself. Average matters. Of course it does, because it's a component that goes into on-base and slug. So it matters. But ask Luis Arraez how much batting average matters when it comes to getting a contract. Because this guy's a career 300 hitter. The problem is he does nothing else.
You ain't kidding. Average don't pay. So, you know, you don't chase it. That's exactly right.
And the stats that we see.
And you know what we're going to start seeing not pay is ERA, too. That's not.
No, you're right. Because, see, this is the thing that it's hard to describe to people that haven't kept up. But what we see, these stats are great for telling us what has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
They're not predictive, though.
Oh, you're going to get me on my speech.
Predictive. Yeah. So, like, if you want to know what already happened, these stats tell you. And if you want to know what's probably going to happen, because nothing is definitely going to happen, because we don't have time machines or crystal balls. But if you want to know what's probably going to happen, you have to look deeper than these numbers.
There are three types of stats. This is my soapbox, and this is what I'm – I should write a book about this.
Make a t-shirt out of it.
Make a t-shirt out of it. That's
so we can wave it at the ball game when we
you're
get
right.
tarps
no, off. You're right. T-shirts are the new novels. You're correct. I should do a TikTok about this.
You should make a bumper sticker.
I'm going to do a TikTok about this. I'm going to get campaign buttons. So there are three types of stats, and I wrote about this actually way back in college, I think, or if not, then straight out of college, but it was something on my mind. It was about the time when, like, wins and RBIs were taking all this bruising, right?
Right, right, right.
And I was like, well, they still have a place in baseball. Wins and RBIs do. They still have a place in baseball. But there are three types of stats. There are narrative stats. There are qualitative stats.
Mm-hmm.
And there are predictive stats.
Yeah.
Okay, narrative stats are like wins and RBIs. We need them to tell the story of the game.
Correct.
They are shorthand for what happened in the game.
Correct.
They are not qualitative. They can be quantitative. They are not qualitative because they don't tell us about the context.
Right. Right. Was quality. It a blooper or was it a rocket? Right.
Correct. The quality of the performance. Then there are qualitative stats, and those are the ones that go deeper, like fielding independent ERA, you know, slugging percentage is a qualitative stat or has qualitative personalities. You know, we go much further than that. Certainly average exit velocity.
Oh, you could broaden that out to OPS too, right? Because you'll factor OPS, in the extra base plus the on base.
You know, all of those have qualitative factors. WAR, wins above replacement, is a qualitative stat. Defensive runs saved. It's telling us not just what happened, but the quality of what happened in shaping the game. Win probability added. Big fan of that. You know, qualitative stat. All right. Predictive stats. Predictive is the next level. And this is where teams live because they need to.
Because you're trying to forecast the future,
They're trying to forecast future performance. And so the predictive stats, they range from some pitch metrics to what styles of pitches, shapes of pitches.
Oh, it's shapes, it's tunneling, it's velocity, it's spin rate, it's
it's extension,
launch angle, it's barrels,
perceived velocity. Yeah. Right, correct. It's now
extension. There you go for perceived velocity, extension.
Extension, right. One predictive stat that is very tangible, is strikeout rate. Right. That can be a it's both a qualitative and predictive. Mm-hmm. And now, thankfully, it's also a narrative stat. So it crosses all three, just to give folks a perspective, is this notion that, like, all right, strikeout rate is what rate are you missing bats? And it's one thing. I mean, again, going back 15, 20 years, one of the things that I often wrote about when I was writing about minor league guys was, their hits and strikeouts per inning. I would very rarely make reference to their, I mean, we had to sometimes put like their win-loss record in their ERA.
That
was secondary to me. And I always included, here are their innings, here are their hits allowed, and here are their strikeouts. And there was one time in the Cardinals organization, again, two plus decades ago, when the Cardinals did not have a starting pitcher who had more innings than hits allowed. And this was a big concern for them. Yeah, this was a huge concern for them. I think it was every pitcher who had thrown more than 90 pitches had allowed more than 90 hits.
Okay.
And also, like, if you threw 90 innings. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody who had allowed or pitched more than 90 innings had allowed more hits than innings.
Right.
So if you threw 120 innings, you allowed at least 121.
Right.
Anyway, so it was like a stunning number that spoke to their pitch to contact ethos, right, but they were like, we don't have velocity like these other teams, we don't have some of this. Well, in came the onrush, led by John Mozeliak and Jeff Lunau and Sig Madel and the guys of drafting and looking for those guys, right? And you had the arrival of the Carlos Martinez, the Trevor Rosenthal, Kevin Segrist. Remember, like, a big jump for him was like, throw harder. Right.
Yeah.
You had that influx of guys. Now, not all starters, right? But several of them were, like, at least brought up as starters.
Right.
And this notion was like, you have to get more in line with that predictive stat of more swings and misses. Because what's gonna happen is these minor league guys who are allowing more hits than innings pitched are going to move up, and some of them are going to have success, and they're going to graduate to the majors. And those more hits than innings pitch are going to be more damage than innings pitch. And that's a problem. And so they, you know, you could see how a predictive stat like strikeout rates is applied.
Yep. Pretty much it. And
there you go. So that's again, my speech on stats. There's narrative, which still has value to help us tell the story. There's qualitative, which has real value when determining salaries and how a game happened, and how to look at, like, a player's career and whether they're a Hall of Fame and all that stuff. Qualitative really matters. So you have narrative, qualitative, and then finally predictive, and that's where the teams live.
Yep. And if you get too heavy on any one of those categories, you're probably going to miss stuff. You've got to weight them all.
Yeah, I'm narrative not so much when you're a team.
No, but I mean for telling, right. But I'm talking about for, like, understanding and telling the story and having and being a fan too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, totally if you weigh those two things, the narrative stats too much, well, you're missing the boat.
Yeah.
And if you ignore them completely, you're missing part of the fun and part of the story.
Right. Correct. Yeah. All right. So it's good that, like, before, you know, we launched into my screed. How about this, man? I'm keeping my voice. Cool.
Yeah.
Before I launched into my 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 statistical preacher revival speech about the different types of stats, is the we were talking about power and
right.
Jordan Walker, what he brought, but also the first baseman in the National League Central. So here's my question for you is we've discussed the vibe at Busch Stadium, and you've mentioned the red flags for the starters. What of the past few weeks, what has staying power for the Cardinals? Do you think, I think we both feel that like if the play continues, not necessarily the wins, but wins obviously help.
Right.
But if the style of play continues, Cardinals have seen an uptick in ticket sales, so they are expecting larger crowds. The mm-hmm. Cubs are on the horizon.
That's right.
That could be a huge trampoline mm-hmm. for a vibe at Busch Stadium. We both question, I think, whether the starting rotation can continue to keep this up. Again, we'll look at predictive stats. There's some concern there.
Sure.
So what has staying power for the Cardinals? Do they have staying power as a contender, Kevin?
I think so. Well, the first thing, their biggest, I think their greatest point of stability is probably the defense,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the least likely thing to vary
between
now and the end of the year, right?
Now,
maybe the defense in center steps back just a little bit if, say, when Newt's back, Victor Scott finds his way out of the lineup or back to Memphis. Because Church, I think, will be good in center, but I think Scott's better. But I don't mm-hmm. think that's a big drop-off, right? I think that's a little bit of a drop-off if we're looking at it big picture. But you would still be, you know, solid in right, solid in left, strong at short and second, strong behind the plate when Pajes is catching. Burley's been really good. Gorman's been surprisingly good. He's been really good defensively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just speaks to settling down and having a home at a position you grew up playing your entire life. So
well, I think also like being able to dedicate it to, I mean, he went
he didn't
to
have to
work.
Do more than one thing.
Yeah. Right. And he went to work at third base.
Yeah.
This winter, I think I wrote a story about him going to Las Vegas to work with an infield coach and how he took in grounders in a ballroom at a mm-hmm. at Luxor at the casino there in Vegas. And, mm-hmm. you know, just learn some little tips, learn some little drills that have continued. And then Stubby Clapp has really worked a lot with him.
Yep.
He's also, you know, he's also moving around better, right? He's not as locked up with his back. He's able to work out. He's more agile. Mm-hmm. All that's playing in.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's to me what you can absolutely bank on.
Mm-hmm.
Barring a significant injury, you know, like win misses big time or whatever. You can bank on a strong, a B plus to A plus type defense, right?
Yeah.
Like at the very least, it's going to be good, and it could continue to be great because I think it's been pretty great so far. That's to me the obvious. This is probably not going to change because defense, speaking of predictability, is the most predictable thing.
Yes.
Typically, a good defender is a good defender, and that doesn't change very much.
Correct.
And
defensive team is a good defensive team. And a good defensive team with a lot of balls in play is going to spin a lot of outs.
Yes. So that, to me, is the easiest thing that will continue. The top four in the order, to me, will stay quality. The question is, will Walker be this or just good instead of great the rest of the way? Because I think I'm past the worry about a collapse. I don't see signs of that guy. I don't see those signs body language wise. I don't see those things at the plate. I don't see the same. He's not swinging at the breaking ball off the plate low and away all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think all the mechanical things certainly matter and everything matters when it puts you in the right mindset. But his swing decisions have been so good. He's mm-hmm. not missing pitches that he missed last year and he's not swinging at things he can't hit typically. And yeah, he's going to strike out. So what? Aaron Judge strikes out too. It's fine. Right. As long as you're not making weak outs to go along with that, right? As long as when you hit it hard, it's okay. Strikeouts are fine. But I don't have any concerns about Burleson's performance, like as far as up or down. I think he's going to be the guy you expect him to be. I think same thing for Herrera, same thing for Weatherholt. I don't care if he's a rookie. To me, he's a guy that I feel like I can see the same thing for 6 months. Maybe there are some physical obstacles, like playing 160 games and doing this every day for 6 months. And maybe that'll be a up and down thing that you'll see from rookies on a pretty regular basis, but he'll overcome it because he's just a guy. That's what he does. So I feel really solid about that. And I think you've got the makings of a bullpen that can be even better than it's been. I thought the bullpen before the year, I think you agreed. I thought the bullpen was going to be one of the strengths of the team
mm-hmm.
and parts of it have been, But I thought it would be bigger. I mean, I thought Swanson would be a little more toward the high end, and he's really struggled. Standing has been about what you would expect.
Yeah, I mean, Swanson might still put it together. I mean,
he might, but boy, you talk about a shock. To me, the shocking switcheroo from a guy that nobody could do anything against last year to the guy that is bottom of the league in like average exit velocity. He's in the bottom 2% of pitchers. No, that's crazy for a guy with that stuff.
Yeah.
But it speaks to command, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he threw a lot more strikes last year, which means he controlled a count. When he's behind in the count, you're going to be more predictable. You're going to give up more damage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you throw in the fact that his walk rate has dropped or is increased dramatically. It's gotten worse in a dramatic way. And then, you know, the worst hard hit rate in baseball. I'm a little worried about that coming back. Now, it's there, though. You can see he's still 97, 98.
Mm-hmm.
He'll still have little flashes, a game here, a couple batters there, where he's like, that's the dominant guy.
So has the bowling ball sinker. And then the bat
stuff comes back.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it won't come back completely, but, I mean, he's in a spot almost into June that I would never have guessed.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. But other guys have stepped up. Like, I wouldn't have necessarily predicted George Soriano would be reliable. And he's been pretty good.
I mean, the Cardinals clearly saw something in him. And also, you know, you talk about, like, a confluence of events, right? Like, it just – it's all worked for him in the sense that, like, they saw a pitch profile and a usage profile that they're like, man, we flipped this. We really got something. And they were willing to give up a guy with options to do it, knowing that they would be landlocked. But they thought, well, Soriano's worth it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. We move on to somebody else, right? And then Soriano comes in. And, oh, by the way, he meets Kyle Leahy, which he's not going to do with any other team. And Kyle Leahy shows him how he kind of journals pitches and how he looks at stuff. And then, you know, he gives him one of these handmade kind of journal things that he had. And Soriano now uses it daily. And he was telling me that it helps him kind of collect his thoughts and know how to attack individual hitters as opposed to just, this is my best stuff.
Right.
He kind of knows this is my best stuff against this guy.
Right.
And that's just radically changed his pitch mix so that he's not out there going, well, here's my best pitch over and over and over and over again. They flipped it and he's having great performance as a result.
He has, but there's some red flags there too.
Fair. I mean, you know, look,
His barrel rate's pretty bad.
Is his role reliever? Look, it's volatile business.
No, man. That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
you know,
that's a great point.
I mean,
that's the job, basically.
I mean, you show me a bullpen that's gone to Sacramento, and I will show you a bullpen that has the money.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, going to Sacramento and facing the top of that A's lineup
that
ballpark is every team that goes there, their engine light is going to go on for the bullpen.
Yep.
It's going to happen. That's an underrated A's top of the order.
Yeah.
It's a very small ballpark. It's just tough. And you're going to have some. I mean, one thing that like Justin Brule, right, the lefty, has been, I think, a surprise in a lot of ways. He walks a lot of folks, but he also misses bats. And so, like, it's kind of like this shouldn't work, but it has now worked for almost 2 months. So maybe it does work. Well, he has a better strikeout rate going than some of the
His whip rate is like in the bottom 12% in baseball.
Relatively speaking, let me rephrase that.
You're watching a different guy than I'm watching.
No. You're right. Relatively speaking to other guys on the pitching staff globally.
Okay.
And you know what he does. I mean, and he has found ways to miss. I mean, he walks guys and then he'll strike out a guy.
You just can't be the guy that throws 90 and has a 14% walk rate. I mean, you can't be that guy.
I mean, evidently you can. Like,
you got a 5 ERA and an expected ERA above that.
But ERA is like one of the stats that we're talking about just a few minutes ago that we have to kind of look past. Expected ERA is different. Yes, correct.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, expected slug, expected weighted on base, I mean, all those things are bad.
Look, I mean, Michael McGreevy has the lowest batting average against.
Yeah.
and starters, and look at that ERA. But now go look at expected ERA.
No, I think there are some of the same red flags. But
so it's kind of like,
what makes me not worry about him is the elite walk rate. When you don't walk people, you can do that.
I think we're saying the same thing. Is like some of this stuff is like, why is it working? How can this possibly still work? And yet it's working. Like, there are elements of like, okay, when does this catch up with the Cardinals?
Well, that's the question, right? Like, isn't that like the $200 million question for 2026 is, does any of this stuff catch up to you over the next 4+ months?
That's my question, is like, what is staying power?
Yeah. And I think that's what's interesting is I honestly think that there's a lot to love here and a lot that I do believe will stay good. I trust McGreevy, even with some of the nervous numbers, like the expected numbers, because of the command. An elite trait can overcome other things that are not great. And that's an elite trait for him. I do think they're going to need reinforcements from within in the very near future, because the bench is completely helpless. You don't get much from the bench.
Interesting.
And you've got the bottom three
you
or
say
four.
This after four. Pozo has a walk-off hit.
I mean, I know, but come on. He's got 27 at-bats on the year, right? I mean, how reliable is he if he's never playing?
Right. No, that's fair. I mean, that's part of the gig.
But you're getting nothing. You know, I know Arias was hurt, but he's not, you got to stop using him against right-handed pitching. He cannot hit right-handed pitching. And Gorman is so good defensively right now, I don't see the trade-off being worth it.
No,
you're going to need another bat, and I would say preferably a bat that's from the left side, which Newt can bring you, but if he's here, he's not going to be on the bench. He's going to start.
No, I think you're going to see. Yeah, right. That's right.
So, what do you get out of I don't mean this negatively because I like Thomas Ajayi, but he's also a guy that just doesn't get to play very much, and it's hard to fix things when you're not playing. Fermin fits well. I think he's done a nice job. He's versatile. He can put the ball in play.
All
I think he's
true.
Got a spot. But, boy, are you really stretching when you're carrying three catchers and when you have nobody with Pop on the bench?
But
nobody.
Who is that?
I mean, maybe it's – look, this is the problem is that the guy that I would bring up for that is going to change the entire dynamic of what you want to do behind the plate right now. Because a guy that could add some lefty pop as a part-time starter and a part-time player is Jimmy Crooks. But that would basically mean ending Ivan Herrera as a catcher.
So this has come up here recently.
Right? I mean,
because
you're not moving on from Pop. What's that?
No. But so why? Like, this has come up recently. I've seen – the other folks I had it pushed towards me, you know, Herrera hasn't thrown a guy out. There's a lot more to catching than that, but that's a big part of it.
It's a pretty big deal when you go.
No, huge.
You know, year and a half without throwing anybody out.
No, it's real. I'm not doubting it. And this is your area of expertise behind the plate. Cause you spent a lot of time watching someone else do it at Miami.
And here, by the way, a nice privilege to follow watching Charles Johnson with watching Yachty.
Yeah. But you got to, actually be
close,
in the same gear, waiting for your turn with Charles Johnson there.
no turn ever came. Yeah. Narrator, there was never a turn.
Yeah, he could throw some guys out.
He was pretty great.
But Herrera's improved. I don't think there's any other way to say it.
No, he has.
He's improved behind the plate.
His game calling has gotten better. I think his framing is pretty good. He's great with the ABS.
He's great with the ABS.
I mean, I think there's some value there, but this is the point though, is if
teams are stealing less against him. He hasn't thrown anybody out.
That's the shocking part to me. Why is nobody running?
Because they're doing better telling teams not to. Like, that is part of policing. The base running is teams don't even try.
Right, but why wouldn't you try if he's back there? I would run all day if he was back there.
But you would be out then.
He's not throwing anybody out.
But he's not throwing anybody out because teams go, this is what his time is. Are you less than this time? Go. And his time is such that not many people have a time less than that. It's not like you don't see teams taking the risk because they know he's going to throw to the wrong base, side of the base, right? Which is what was a big part of it. Now, he still does have balls at tail towards the other wrong side of the base, and that gives more time. But I'm telling you, man, like, it is a mathematical equation to steal bases now.
Do they have a steal on him, man? He's bottom of the league in pop time. He's got no arm strength whatsoever, and he's not accurate.
So why aren't
I would say
doing
game
it?
Circumstances probably playing into it.
So why aren't
because
teams
a lot of
it?
Close games? I don't know. I truly don't know. I would run on him
yes,
all
you
the
do.
Time.
Yes, you do know.
No,
if,
I don't.
if teams are doing this calculation and it says don't steal, they're not stealing. Like, well, we have the answer in the action.
There's a part of this, though, where teams by nature in the modern game are super, even now with the changes, super conservative when it comes to running the bases.
Because they're doing the math. I'm not even.
Right, but the so math, that, I mean, like, there's another part to the math that doesn't get in this, and that's accuracy.
No, it does.
Not accurate. He never puts the ball on the bag. I can't think of a single throw that I've seen from him that was on the fly on the bag.
I can think of throws this season where he's thrown and it's gone to the first. Well,
certainly
side
not
of the
with
bag.
Somebody stealing. Because he hasn't thrown anybody out.
Yeah, he's had some runners beat him.
Okay, but so if your ball is on
because
the bag.
Because of the math.
Right, I'm but sorry, if the ball is on the bag, how are you not throwing people out? You're not getting it there fast
because
enough.
Because they're faster than you, and they have a better jump. Yeah. And they know this. Look, I mean, he's not throwing Victor Scott out if Victor Scott has a great jump. He's not throwing Chandler Simpson out if Chandler Simpson has a great jump.
Well, nobody
jump.
Is throwing
he's
those
not
guys
throwing out.
Out
Jordan Walker if Jordan Walker has a great jump. He just doesn't have that kind of pop time. But they're doing – like it's and I don't want to be on the side of this because I feel like I'm doing the science and not the art of baseball. But I watch teams discuss this. I watch opponents talk about this. And I know the Cardinals do it where they just do the math. And there's no like risk beyond that to say, well, we might get a guy here who throws it. I mean, they do take that into account, right? Because that's part of pop time, right? Is not just the catch on the far side, but when does
no? It's basically there's a realistic pop time, which includes correct. The taggable type throw.
That's what we're talking about,
right?
And so teams
because a 2.0 on the bag is better than a 1.8 to the shortstop side.
Correct. All right. And teams know that. Teams are smart. Scouts are smart. They know that. That's what they clock. And if the math is wrong, they don't go. And we just don't see teams.
I just don't get going. How the math is. I mean, I do the math, Derek. I mean, I've done the math on catching stuff for a long time.
Yeah,
I don't see how ranking in the bottom quarter of the league in pop time is deterring anyone.
It's weird. I mean,
don't get me wrong. The guys he catches are really good at controlling the running game.
So that this is part of that equation is credit to the pitcher. That's what I
sure. Sure. I think that's a fair thing. And I think still run.
Look, man. Like we watched the Cubs with John Lester on the mound and William.
Yeah.
And Wilson Contreras behind the plate, and we would go, why aren't they running? Like, what are you doing? You know what? Teams would go, they're throwing us off. They're doing different things.
Well, see, to me, this has been a trend in baseball for a long time.
We were like, walk to second base. Go ahead, do it. Just walk.
No,
walk
this has been a trend, and this is to me one of the negatives that can come from being too based in simply risk reward, like just the math, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because historically speaking, base stealers, the average base stealer is saved 70 to 75% of the time.
Which is not enough in today's game.
No. I get it, but that's my point. Like if you ran more, you would be safe way more often than you would run yourself out of a two-run homer. Because the two-run homer is only going to happen 4% of the time. Like this is a league-wide groupthink that's been going on for 20 or 30 years.
Yes.
And it's always baffled me. And I think people talk themselves into that this is too risky when the reality is I don't think it is.
I really desperately want to believe you, Kevin. I want to be on your side. I do. I really, really do. I really do, man.
Everybody's so worried about a guy getting thrown out because then the next guy might hit a home run. Well, correct. You know what? He's got a 94% chance of not hitting a home run. 94% chance.
Yeah, no, I know.
I mean, your best home run hitters are what? 7-8% of the time?
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Aaron Judge doesn't even hit a home run 10% of the time, and he's the best there is.
Teams don't steal second as often. We're going to do this. All right. Teams don't steal second as often because the math. Because even the speediest guys who could steal second like that are in scoring position and first for a double.
Right. So it's and not many, just, what, what's it's not the just frequency a home of run. A double?
No, it's not just a home run. It's damage, right?
Right. And it's all team. Right. Let's and take I, the frequency I, of all extra base hits combined. What's the frequency of all such, extra base hits combined?
This is the time where I wish my voice gave out because I want to agree with you. I really do. But let's also be honest with the listeners that teams' data sets are a whole lot more than two guys talking in a podcast right now.
I totally agree. And I also know that decisions a lot of times in
and what we wish.
I also know that a lot of decisions in baseball, in sports, but I'm risk adverse. They are fear based.
Yeah, risk adverse.
We can't take this risk.
Totally.
And I think that's and it's that fear that I'm talking about. I'm not saying the numbers are all wrong, but I'm saying the numbers are guided by that fear. Yeah, when you don't try, you're going to not steal. Like, I mean, it's just not going to happen.
All right. No,
I guess what I would say, you definitely hit this. I think you hit the wording. The sport has become so risk averse that they don't even bother. And if there's viewed as any risk at all, they're just not going to do it.
This is where the Cardinals have kind of found a market inefficiency. And if you're talking about whether or not that they have staying power, this might be where it is. And, you know, again, you and I have talked so much about this. I remember you and I designed a fantasy baseball game or tried to. I did when I was younger, was a fantasy baseball game based on 90 feet. Like, how many 90 feet do you stop someone from taking? How many 90 feet do you take? And the game right now is all about 180 feet or more.
Fair,
and that's true with hitters. That's true. I mean, it's less true with strikeouts, but you know, it's basically you're trying to strike somebody out who's trying to go for 180. You want to make sure.
Right.
So the game has this 180 aspect to it. And the Cardinals are playing a 90-foot game.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They are trying to stop teams from taking the extra 90 feet. And they are trying to generate, because of the kind of nature of offense they have, the extra 90 feet. That is why J.J. Weatherholt, with that low average that he has, and he's been searching for hits here for a while, let's be candid, but he still is a valuable and contributing part of the offense because he's taking extra 90 feet. He's taking 90 feet that he has not earned, right? He's earned, but he's taking the 90-foot walk. He's taking the extra base, everything like that. So I get where you're coming from because, like, if you're going to be a 90-foot team, and I think definitely the Cardinals are, and in a way they found that market inefficiency, you probably need to dial up the risk-taking when it comes to going for that 90 feet steals. We'll see. I mean, they need Victor Scott on base more often to really do it. You know, we've seen Jordan Walker steal plenty, which I think is a sign.
That's great.
That element of his game. So I think, you know, if you talk about like the general sense of this conversation about what has staying power, it does come back to this steals and this math conversation is the Cardinals are playing a 90 foot game. And a lot of teams are looking for the less, to your point, the less probable but more impactful 180-foot game or 360-foot game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the best version of baseball is the meshing of the two. And kind of what we've seen from the Cards. I mean, look, it's changed a little bit in the last week or so, but, I mean, they've been top 8, 10 in home runs in the league the whole season.
Yeah.
So you're getting damage.
Jordan Walker.
Yeah, I mean, again, Walker and Weatherholt, you know, like 40% of that, just those two guys.
Yeah. I mean,
it's still been part of the game, right? I mean, it's still a big part of why they're good.
It is,
because without that, you're basically last year's offense.
Yeah. All right. Let's close here with a little more conversation about risk adverse.
Yes.
And fear based decisions. Are you worried about Mandalorian and Grogu?
I'm always worried about the Star Wars franchise because they keep stepping on their own tail lately. I don't know, like, because I've seen some of the early reviews, they're pretty mediocre. But the question I would have is that actually that it's mediocre, or did the show set a standard that the movie just didn't meet? As an example, like a different franchise but a similar idea. You ever watched the TV show Deadwood?
I did not.
When you have time in the off season, Derek, you need to watch the entire series of Deadwood. It's phenomenal. The movie was still good, but it wasn't the series. It wasn't as good. And it sounds like this is kind of the same vibe. And I always wonder, I always worry about something going to the big screen because not theaters, studios, movie makers tend to studio it up when you're going for the big screen as opposed to just streaming a TV series or whatever. And I wonder if that turns off a lot of people. So I'm curious to see if that's going to be legitimately a bad step backward, or if it's just the expectations were so high that you just can't meet them.
Yeah. I mean, they're taking a leap from the fact that, and this is the same thing the TV show ran into, was you had an adorable property and now you had to have him fight.
Yeah. I mean, and look, Yoda fought too, man. I mean, you know, that was wicked, but
Yoda was old. Yoda, I don't think anybody was going, Yoda's cute. I mean, Yoda was presented as a mentor and a crotchety old man who you were like, man, there's like, you know, I mean, he's the classic samurai mentor. We've seen that over David Carradine, all that stuff. Revisited in Quentin Tarantino, everything like that. It's very rare in a narrative that you have, man, that's a cute baby. Man, that cute baby is coming to kick my ass. You know,
I mean, it is a baby with the force powers, though. So,
Right.
Changes a little, but I think that what's fascinating. I mean,
that was the turn that TV show had to take. And now the movie has to really lean in to this cute, you know, creature who everybody finds adorable now has to be a hero. How does that, you know,
I think that's the really interesting part is how do you stop it being all about the cuteness? You know, that's a hard thing when you're talking about child stars. I know this is not the child star, but it's the same idea. And to me, back tying this into baseball, Star Wars fans, and I'm obviously one, you're one, we're a little bit like Dodgers fans right now. Mm-hmm. Anything but a World Series win is going to be a disappointment.
I think that's really well
put. And I think that series in particular is the Dodgers because it was so great. Mm-hmm. And had some moments where, like, hair on the back of your neck stands up. It was interesting and different and fun and cute and all of these things. Mm-hmm. And you had CGI Luke come back, and we see him at his full powers in the middle of that show. Like, we never saw that before. And at least not to the degree we did in that scene. And you know which one I'm talking about. And anything short of the World Series victory is going to be seen as a disappointment, just like it will be for the Dodgers if they don't win at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's really well put. I'm gonna go see it, and here's my hope, Kevin. Are you ready for my hope? Okay, yes. I'm gonna go see it. I'm gonna see it with a friend. I'll probably drag that friend onto the podcast to do a review, or maybe I'll get film school student,
nice
young lad, Ian Gould, 20-year-old.
Oh, that'd be a good take to get.
Yeah, so maybe I'll drag him into. But here's what I want. I want a movie that is enjoyable enough that I don't need the Stephen F. Austin team there to whip off their shirt and get people excited. We don't need tarps off at the theater.
Yeah.
I don't want tarps off. I want helmets off, not tarps off at the movie theater. That's what I want.
I'm with you. I share the same hope and expectation.
That is Kevin Wheeler of Camo X, who has helped me get through this. Thank you very much, Kevin. You can find him at Camo X. You know where to find it. 104.1 on the FM dial, 1120, as always, on the AM dial. He's part of the Gas House Gang. He's part of the Drive Time Show, DGS. He's all over the place. He's a great friend and a great help as my voice starts to falter here. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the best podcast in baseball. You can find the BPIB wherever you get your podcasts. It's brought to you by Closets by Design, as my voice cracked. It's brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. It's been a great conversation. It's great to be back. I know I have some catching up to do on the podcast. I look forward to begging Kevin to help me do it. So thanks, Kev.
Glad to do it anytime, buddy.
Much appreciated, Keebler. Enjoy the movie. We'll talk soon.
You got it, buddy.